Welcome, action fans, and thanks for joining us for another edition of All 90s Action All the Time, in what is the first of our bonus episodes where we look at a film that is in some way connected to our main season and stars somebody that we won't be doing a whole season on, but we're just covering this one film, or maybe we'll cover one of their other films later, either because like their body of work is too small or maybe because we just don't want to cover them. Anyway, I am one of your hosts, Scott Murphy, and joining me, as always, is podcaster, screenwriter, and a man who I really need to think up new intros for because I can't now just liken him to Seagal all the time, Mr. Kyle Hintz.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Anyway, also, we were going to have our other regular co-host, Mr. Craig Dryme, but he is off on a secret CIA mission somewhere else in an undisclosed location and unfortunately could not join us for this recording. So what are we talking about today? Well, we are talking about 1992's Rapid Fire. And what is the Seagal connection? Well, it was directed by Marked for Death director Dwight H. Little. It turns out this is not the only Seagal connection that I found, but this was the initial one, the initial inspiration of like, oh, well, you know, that's the connection right there. So that's why I put it into this season. But it turns out there is a bunch of Seagal connections throughout the movie, 7 that I counted. So we'll count, you can count along with us for that one. Some other details on the film. The story was written by Cindy Searle and Alan B. McElroy. Cindy Searle doesn't have a whole lot of other credits. In fact, she only has one other credit for a movie called Black Rose, which is a rock and roll horror movie, which sounds interesting. I've not seen it. I'll possibly check it out. Alan B. McElroy is most famous probably for creating the Wrong Turn franchise. He wrote the first one and the newest one that came out, and had previously collaborated with Dwight H. Little when he wrote the screenplay for Halloween 4. He is the only person credited for the screenplay. The story was written by Cindy Searle and himself. In terms of reviews, it has a 6.3 on IMDb, which is very high compared to some of the recent ratings. 45% on Rotten Tomatoes based on 22 reviews, which again is still technically a rotten rating, but much higher than something we've covered recently. And it has no Metacritic score, and it's got a 3.1 on Letterboxd. Tragically, it was also Brandon Lee's penultimate film in his career, his last film obviously being The Crow. So, before we get into the plot of this one, Kyle, had you seen Rapid Fire before?
Yes, I had.
How long ago was that?
It's probably almost been like 20 years. It's been a while.
Yeah, I was the same. I feel like I've also seen it before, but again, it's got to be like over 20 years. I can't remember what film I had on video, but that had the trailer for this on it, but I definitely owned something that had the trailer for this on it, which then inspired me to rent it on VHS. So we're talking a long time ago that I checked this movie out. But yeah, I remember it being fun, and it turns out my memory was correct.
Yeah, it was a blast.
It is. It's definitely a fun one to watch. So, Kyle, do you want to take us, tell us about the opening of the film? What do we get into first?
Yes, we are floating down a river in Thailand.
Oh no, are you going to skip over the slow motion bit?
Oh, well, yeah, you're right. There's an amazing, almost James Bond-esque kind of opening, just with Brandon Lee in slow motion doing karate moves, basically doing martial arts moves.
I definitely feel like it deserves to be mentioned because it's kind of surreal because it's done in this kind of weird slow-mo time-lapsey thing. And then, but he also appears to be sparring in a black void. And then we just pan onto, you know, his face. And then we get the title Rapid Fire Brandon Lee, like, you know. So I think it was a fun opening worth mentioning.
Yeah, it definitely was. That's why I remembered it.
we'll edit out the bit where you just skipped over it, sure. So, you've kind of given us a hint on what happens next. What happens next, Kyle?
Next, we float down a river in Thailand with our Chicago mob boss, Antonio Serrano, who's meeting his drug connection, Tao.
For the Seagal connection count, who is Antonio Serrano played by?
Nick Mancuso, a.k.a. Tom Breaker himself.
And I also love that when we are riding down the river in Thailand with Nick Mancuso, he's just like Tom Breaker. He's doing his favorite Nick Mancuso thing, which is smoking and looking menacing.
He does it well.
He really does.
We also have, I feel like you're going to know these guys' names, but his henchmen and Tao are both recognizable faces. I don't know the actors' names off the top of my head, but I know I've seen them in a lot of stuff.
Oh, his henchmen are the you mean the big guy? Whose character name is Brunner Gazi, and is played by an actor called Tony Longo. Like you say, kind of has a recognizable face. Like, yeah. So, there's a lot of recognizable faces in this movie, including the guy Mr. Serrano is going to meet.
Yes.
Who is played by, I think his name is pronounced Taima. It's spelled T-Z-I, and then his surname is just Emmy, but so I think it's Taima. It's how you pronounce that. And I did want to, I don't know if you thought about this, right? But Rapid Fire came out in 1992. Rush Hour came out in 1998, 6 years later. In this film, Taima looks like a boy, and he looks practically middle-aged. In when he's playing Consul Han in Russia, it's just something that I was thrown by.
I mean, maybe he had makeup or something, but
I don't know. Yeah, do you not think so as well, or am I just misremembering how old he looked in Russia?
Because I can't. Well, yeah, off the top of my head, like I remember him in Rush Hour, but I don't remember him. I haven't seen him forever, so I don't remember him looking drastically different or not.
Hmm. I just felt like maybe it's because he's playing a father role or whatever, you know, like.
Yeah, it might just be his acting.
Yeah. Yeah. It might just be that, he comes across like way older in Rush Hour. Cause like I checked his age and like, actually when Rush Hour was made, he'd only be like 36. He's like 58 now. So like presumably when this film was filmed as opposed to when it came out, he'd be like 29. He was.
I mean, maybe I don't want to spoil the ending of this movie, but maybe what happens to him at the end aged him significantly.
Yeah, we'll definitely get to that. That is entirely possible. Maybe he has that took years off him. So
we all know that's how movies work.
That is absolutely how movies work. Yes, tell us a bit more about this meeting, because it's a fun meeting.
Yes. So they're in cahoots to bring drugs from Thailand into Chicago and wherever else. And Tao has like a great, he has a moment with like a staff that he pounds against the ground, and then he says something about fear the man, not the weapon.
Yes,
something
that's
like that.
That's what he says when they get off the boat. Yeah, yeah, he says to one of his henchmen, fear the man, not the weapon.
And then don't they, like, watch a fight that's going on?
Yeah, there's, like, a martial arts, like a stick fighting tournament going on for some reason. And then, like, Serrano is like, "Why I didn't fly, like, 10,000 miles to, like, watch this." And then, yeah, he tries to threaten Tao, or Tommy, as he refers to him, and some other people refer to him. Like, there's a lack of consistency in terms of, like, what people are named in this film, which can be occasionally confusing, particularly with one character, but I'll get to that. So, yes, and then after he's threatened, then Tommy stroke Tao, just beats up a couple of guys, like the people who were doing the martial arts tournament, the stick fighting tournament. He joins in and he just beats both of them up. And then he says something in Sicilian to Serrano.
Oh, yeah.
And, basically saying, you know, like, you know, you want some from me, come get it. You know, you're going to be man enough to come get it, basically, which, Mr. Serrano is not happy about whatsoever.
Understandable. It's also pretty bold of him to come to Thailand with one other guy and threaten people.
Yeah, he thought that Big Gazi was, you know, threatening enough, burly enough, and threatening enough that he would be scared. No, but he wasn't scared of that. Also, I was just, I thought I'd quickly look it up because I didn't know kind of offhand. Tony Longo, actually. Yeah, he is in a bunch of things. Sadly, he passed away in 2015, aged only 53. But he was in such 80s films as 16 Candles, Splash, and Fletch. He was also in Mulholland Drive and a bunch of other things.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that was... That's the career of Tony Longo. But he was definitely like a face I recognized as kind of being like the typical mafia goon guy, you know, that kind of typical henchman look, you know. So yeah, so after that, where after the big meeting, we cut to what Brandon Lee as Jake Lowe is up to. What's he doing?
I mean, first off, he's wearing an awesome leather jacket.
Oh, that's great, isn't it?
And he is what? Well, and I guess he's on his way to art class, but he's walking through kind of a square where those people are protesting against Tiananmen Square, and we get a great flashback of that incident. Yeah. And him being there and witnessing his father killed. I guess we don't actually see him get killed exactly, but basically that's what happens.
Well, yes, we don't see the death blow or anything, but you know, we can infer from what we've seen that he dies. And then the guy who organized the rally then Paul Yang, he tries to convince Jake to get in to say something, that there's going to be some sort of event, like some sort of fundraising event, like later, if he could just like say a few words at it. But Jake Lowe ain't having none of that. He's not about politics.
No, he says politics are bullshit, or is bullshit, and that his dad died for nothing.
Yeah, yeah. He doesn't even say his dad. He said the man yeah, died for nothing. Like, so a lot of pent up rage and aggression there. And then he storms off to his life drawing class, where I should mention we get a cameo as the art teacher He's just credited as the arts teacher by Richard Schiff of West Wing fame, which I thought was quite random.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you can tell, like, I guess this is really early in his career.
Yeah, presumably so. Yeah, that's obviously not made a big name for himself yet. But yes, just a random little cameo. And then he tells Jake off for not drawing what's in front of him is a naked lady because it's a life drawing class. But what does he draw?
He draws that naked lady with a cool dragon in the background behind her.
Yes, he does. And that seems to impress her so much that she A, wants the picture, and B, wants to go on a date.
Yes, indeed. And unlike the Seagal films we have been covering, this is believable because it's Brandon Lee. And you're like, yeah, I think a woman would hit on him.
Yeah, absolutely. Apparently, I was like in the research for this movie. I was, I was saying that apparently he worked out with a trainer and like he was doing like 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. Kind of in, wow. Like, yeah, in prep, you know, he did a lot of prep, physical prep for this movie. And I think he really wanted to show that off because we get a lot of loving shots of, Brandon Lee. And, I think he just wanted to make sure that his effort was worth it in terms of all the gratuitous ab shots in this movie.
Well, you can't have too many gratuitous ab shots in a 90s action movie, that's for sure.
Oh, no. No. I mean, no offense to the late Brandon Lee. He was a very attractive man, and this movie just uses any old excuse for him to get his shirt off. And, you know, fair play. If I looked like Brandon Lee, if I had his abs, I'd find any excuse to be topless as well. So, yeah, doesn't bother me.
Yeah, I don't
me.
Blame him.
No, I don't blame him one little bit. So, and not only that, but apart from being an attractive man, he's just a kind of cool guy because, like, in the next scene, we see him on his motorbike because it's the 90s and he's a leather jacket motorbike. He's very much the 90s action hero. And we get some, along with that, he goes to this place where he's meeting his date, the model from the life drawing class. And, we get some classic kind of noirish sax music playing. So we know we're in a kind of crime action movie.
Yeah. That part really stood out to me and I loved it. It was like the, just so 90s action, that music. It was amazing.
I know. I have to say, like, I don't think it's one of his best scores, but like, there's some fun moments in terms of just the cheesiness of it all and the kind of, it is both generically 90s action and generically kind of like doing that kind of traditional, you know, martial arts, you know, Far East kind of music. The music was composed by Christopher Young, who is probably most famous for his score of Hellraiser, I want to say. Well, he is in my mind anyway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the score for Hellraiser is amazing.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And not 90s action at all.
No, he seems to have mainly done scores for action movies and horror movies. I was looking at his IMDb credits and it was, for sure. Cool. But then, yes. So the next scene's kind of weird. Can you tell us about like when he arrives at that said location?
So his date leads him into this like kind of
an art gallery.
Yeah, it's kind of like a warehouse has been converted into a fancy art gallery, and of course he's kind of been duped, and she is she's friends with the Tiananmen Square protesters. And this is their fundraiser. So they just want to get him to say something. And we also, I think there was a short scene. Was there a short scene right before this where Tao meets Chang, who is kind of one of his crime partners.
That is correct. So, like, yes, we get a short scene before this where, like, Chang is one of Tao's distributors in the States, and Tao basically warns Chang that Serrano is trying to muscle in on their heroin dealing business and that Chang better, like, kind of watch his back. And Chang seems highly confident that Serrano can't do anything because, according to him, he's broke and all of his guys are in jail. So that's that problem sorted.
So he thinks.
So he thinks. And then, then we get this art gallery scene where Chang is one of the, it seems like he is the main benefactor of the fundraiser, trying to,
Unless he's just letting them use his art gallery, I don't know if it. I mean, it really doesn't matter.
No,
in the scheme of things.
No, it doesn't matter greatly. The one thing before we get into the kind of action of this scene, the one thing I did want to mention is, like, so when Jake arrives at the door and he is greeted by the life drawing model, who is the character name I looked up. It's Rosalind. She's called Rosalind.
Oh, okay.
And I know that she is lying. You know, it turns out that she is lying to him and she might be nervous about that. But, like, when she invites him into the converted warehouse art gallery, she sounds like somebody who has been taken hostage. She says it in, like, invites him in such a weird, stilted way that I would have ran away, I think. You know, it's just like, is somebody holding you at gunpoint? Like, what am I walking into?
Yeah, it's pretty awkward, especially considering how, like, she knew, well, you know, like, she knew what she was doing and she was very smooth in the art class.
Yes. Yeah. And she, you know, she played her part to perfection in the art class. And then, yeah, she just invites him in and is like, oh, so this is the place. Yes, this is the place. Come in. What's going on?
I mean, he's already seen her naked, so I guess we can excuse him for walking into this trap.
Yeah, fair play. Yeah. So it's interesting as well because, like, she is kind of set up as if she's going to be like a possible love interest or something, or, you know, like a bigger character than she ends up being, because we basically, after the action sequence that is just about to happen, we basically don't see her. We don't see her again. In fact, we lose track of her, like, kind of halfway through this action sequence.
Yeah, I was going to say, in my memory, I imagined Brandon Lee at least got her out of this art gallery, but that doesn't even happen.
That does not happen. We'll discuss that in a minute. Like, so, yes, what kicks off this action sequence, though?
Well, Chang goes to his fancy office in the art gallery, and Serrano is there to ambush him.
Yeah, so Serrano, as gangsters often do in movies, Serrano, like, threatens Chang in an incredibly racist manner. And Serrano is, incredibly racist throughout the movie. And sometimes it's kind of a little bit awkward, just the way he's doing the, you know, the stereotypical Asian man voice, you know the one. And but anyway, also, like, I noticed in this, I don't know if you noticed as well, Nick Mancuso in this one scene, he seems to have, like, a darker dye job than in the rest of the movie. Like, his hair looks real black in this scene.
I didn't really notice, but that makes sense, I guess. It's dark in that room. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
Huck will. It doesn't need to make sense, I suppose. But not then,
shotgun.
Yeah. So then Serrano kills Chang, and this is witnessed by our art student, Mr. Jake Lowe, which then kicks off a big action sequence. which I have some of my favorite moments in this action sequence, but what were some of your favorite moments in this action sequence?
Two specific ones stick out. There's kind of a Jackie Chan type moment where a guy's coming at him and he kicks up, he slides under this table and kicks it into the guy's face.
Yeah.
And catches his gun, or maybe he catches someone else's gun.
Maybe those two. Yeah, right. This is how I saw it, right? So the way it looks is, and I noted it down because I thought it was so entertaining, was, so he does that, and then he basically, like, after decking the guy, he, like, when the guy's on the ground, he, like, the guy is holding a gun, and he snaps his arm, and that flips the gun up into the air, and he catches it.
Okay.
So, which I found very entertaining. I was,
yes.
He just breaks this guy's arm basically in half of him, which makes him let go of the gun and he just catches it. It's great stuff. And what was the other moment that you wanted to talk about?
I feel like I already forgot it. It's chock full. Well, it really is chock full of good moments though.
Yeah, it's got a bunch. Yeah.
Just in this like action scene alone, you know, you're in for a good movie.
Yeah. So like, the other couple that I do want to mention that I did note down was, there's one guy he fights where he puts him in a headlock and then just back heels him in the face like three times in a row, which I thought was quite entertaining. And then he does like one of my favorite kind of martial art movie spots where the guy, like that guy gets free from the headlock, starts fighting him again. But then he throws a kick and the guy catches it in his side.
Oh, yes.
And then he jumps up with the other foot and kicks him in the head, which is a move I always love to see in martial art movies. Gets me every time.
It's a great move. We also get a lot of just good, like there's a little bit of back and forth as opposed to a lot of other action movies where Brandon Lee gets knocked down or gets hit, or it's, you know, the fights are a little, they're not even, but they're a little bit more. He's not just walking through every guy.
Yeah, that's true. There is kind of give and take in the scenes. The other kind of bit that I want to highlight was the guy he like run over with his motorbike through the glass case, which was just this guy. Like again, it feels like a kind of Jackie Chan moment, but like yeah. I thought that was really fun. And then, but yeah, so like kind of halfway through this action sequence, like, cause he's been when the action kind of kicks off, he's kind of protecting Rosalind and then kind of telling her like, oh, you gotta go. I'll keep you safe. Da, 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 da. And then when he goes outside to get his motorbike, which he runs over the guy, he seems to forget about her. And then, like, he just kicks a bunch of guys' ass, and then he smashes through the glass with his motorbike, and then is then arrested. And it's like, oh, we just forgot about that character. Like, it seemed like it was like this big thing to try and save that character, but now she will never be seen again. Maybe she survived. We do not know.
Yeah, and you would think he would just scoop her up. That's what it seems like. They're going to like meet back up before he gets out of there. And then he could still kind of drop that character, I guess. And we would at least know she's alive. But that's not important here. This is rapid fire.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's called rapid fire for a reason. It moves fast, even if some of it really doesn't make sense. So our poor art student, Mr. Jake Low, who apparently has all these martial arts skills, he is arrested. And there is a kind of very brief explanation of why he might be such an expert ass kicker stroke. Later on, we find out marksman. What is that, Kyle?
That is that his father was a martial arts instructor at Langley, and like, was he also in the American military too?
Yeah, like what it certainly said that he trained. He was a martial arts instructor for the military as well. I don't know if he was actually in the military. He might have been. Yeah, I mean
they throw that info at us rapid fire, because when I was watching it, I almost thought they were talking about Brandon Lee himself.
Yes, it is kind of confusing, but I do think I replayed the scene, and I do think it is they are actually talking about his dad, not him, but there is an inference that his dad's been training him since he was a young boy, I suppose. It's an inference I took from it. And as we discussed before the podcast started recording, there is obviously not a lot of knowledge on the American side of the martial arts. Well, and certainly in terms of this actor who is reading out this kind of list of accomplishments of what this guy did. And apparently he instructed the military in Kung Fu, Wing Chun, which he says quite unsure about himself. And then he seems sure about Kung Fu, less sure about Wing Chun. And then he says Muay Thai, but then he pronounces it Muay Thai, and he really drags out all the syllables, and he's clearly never seen those words before.
And it's amazing. I mean, it's a great 90s action moment right there. East meets West. It's like, I have no idea what this sorcery is.
Not a clue. It's just the way he gets less and less sure of himself throughout the line of like Kung Fu, Wing Chun, Muay Thai. Please don't give me other things to say.
Yeah, and also like you're the FBI guy or whatever. Shouldn't you know something? No, just reading out of this file? Okay.
Yeah, for sure. And, so after that, we get an interrogation scene, and you didn't spot it. But there is a cameo from Mark for Death villain Basil Wallace, who, to be fair, does look totally different in this scene to he looks in that movie, because he doesn't have the dreads. He clearly doesn't have the contacts, and of his acting is dialed down to about a 6, where it was at about an 11 in Mark for Death.
Yes, and like as much as I loved him as Screwface, I have to say, knowing that that's him now, I'm like, wow, that guy's a great actor.
So yes, he is interrogated by Agent Wesley, who's played by Basil Wallace, and Agent Stewart, who's played by Raymond J. Barry, and they basically blackmail Jake into giving evidence on their case against Serrano.
Yeah, which is pretty this is where it gets action movie absurd, I guess, because they're just implying that if he doesn't testify, they're going to suggest that he killed all the people in the art gallery.
Yes, they are just saying, oh, we'll frame you. And then, like, Jake kind of says, like, I don't think any judge will buy that. And then Agent Wesley says, oh, my judge will, which suggests that they've got a specific judge on the FBI payroll who will just convict anybody who the FBI says. It's all very sinister.
Yeah, I was going to say, these 90s action cops all just come out looking very corrupt.
they definitely do. And then, yeah, so this is something. When I first, I it's been a long, long time since I've watched this movie. It, you know, like you, the first time and only time I watched this movie was over 20 years ago. So when in the credits and when looking into this film, I saw the name Powers Booth, I just assumed he was going to be one of the villains. But it turns out he is not.
It's funny you mention that too, because in my memory, I remembered like the, you know, like what is to come here soon where we find out some of these people are corrupt. And in my memory, I was like, I think Powers Booth was one of the you know, like FBI guys that turned out to be a bad guy, but he's not.
That was my thought as well. I thought he was like a corrupt FBI guy. Like, but I had kind of, yeah, imagined him as like that as well. It's weird that this year I have rewatched this movie and I watched for the first time Southern Comfort. So this year I have seen Powers Booth be a good guy in two films. It's very, seems very strange.
It is, but he does it well.
He does. He does. He plays Lieutenant Mace Ryan, and he is fun in the role. And this is kind of the point in the film where we get the kind of character introduction of him and who is actually going to be the love interest for the film, Carla Withers, who's played by Kate Hodge, who horror fans may remember from Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, not the other later movie that's also called Leatherface. It's a confusing franchise. Let's not go into it.
Yes, it is. We don't have time for that.
We do not. We got to talk about Rapid Fire.
We've got to, we've got to go to the Fireside Bowl, which is where Lieutenant Ryan and his team of undercover cops, I guess, are like working out of. But I do have to mention that that place is still there.
Is it?
Yeah. Oh, which is pretty cool. So I was like, oh, I know that place.
Sweet. That's really cool indeed. I don't know. Like, it's one of those weird ones where it's like, they are apparently cops. So like, apparently they work for Chicago PD, but, they are, yeah, they're working out of this unused bowling alley. And I just kept thinking, like, I can't think of many undercover, I can't think of many units who work apart from like in like weird places like that. Cause it made me think of like certain TV shows like 21 Jump Street or Ironside, where they don't work in a kind of traditional police station with the other police officers.
Yes. Well, it almost made me think of The Wire, but in The Wire, you just are in a shitty basement. Like, you don't get a cool place to work. You go in like the worst place.
Yeah, for sure.
But this
it looks a bit run down, but it does look like they're having a lot of fun in that unused bowling alley.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like this must have been that'll be a cool place. We're not going to think about how they got this bowling alley. It looks good on film.
No, we're not going to think about anything. Like I love her as well, like where they just lean into the kind of traditional cop stereotypes. Like when Kate Hodges' character has like delivers a decent part of information, Powers Booth is like, he just kind of nods and goes like, well done, go and get yourself a bag of donuts.
Well, and she's his intelligence officer or whatever, so every time she does something it's like, well, you're the intelligence person. Or if she's going to do something stupid, it's like, come on, you're the intelligence person.
Yeah, it's mentioned she's an intelligence person a bunch.
And we also have, and I don't know the actor's name off the top of my head, but there's another detective that feels like it's like, yeah, we'll just throw an Asian guy in here, I guess, because we're investigating this Asian heroin dealer.
That is correct. That character is called Faris, and he is played by Francois Chau. And Francois Chau played Shredder the year before in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze.
Holy shit. That's insane.
Yeah. I was entertained by that as well, because I looked him in the cast and I was like, Francois Chau, I kind of recognize that name. That's what he was in. He was Shredder. I thought it was awesome. Pretty cool. Yeah. Yeah, but it does seem like it's just like, oh, we're investigating an agent. We will talk about that character again later and kind of that kind of weird thing of like, oh yeah, we're investigating an Asian gang, so we must have one Asian person also investigating. But anyway, enough of trying to parse logic out of this. We'll get to more fights. So Jake lands in Chicago. We see his flight lands, and then I think he's quite a fun kind of sarcastic character, because like here, he walks into the hotel, and it's obviously like this rundown kind of motel place, and the FBI agents are like, oh, you know, kind of, how's it going? And he's like, ah, oh, lousy flight, great hotel, which I, you know, he says it in this kind of quippy, cool way that I'm like, no, oh, I like this Jake Lowe.
And those guys do not.
No, those guys, oh, we get more, so there's like nothing much going on, like, Jake Lowe after his flight obviously didn't have an in-flight meal, so he's quite hungry and he's looking for things. Apparently the only things in this room are Pop-Tarts. It's mentioned a couple of times that there's lots of Pop-Tarts, both in the fridge, who's keeping Pop-Tarts in the fridge, and in the cupboard as well. Like, what?
I feel like that's a that's rapid fires, like Godfather trope, like the oranges, like there's Pop-Tarts, something bad is happening.
Yeah, for sure. I just like, I did laugh when that happened, where he's just searching the cupboards and all I could find in the cupboards was Pop-Tarts, and then he searched in the fridge and all I could find in the fridge also Pop-Tarts.
This is pretty great.
Then we get some more, you know, because it's the early 90s, we get some more fun casual racism, where the FBI agents who turn out to be corrupt FBI agents, so it makes sense, says, oh, we could always phone some Chinese. Ha ha ha. Like, they think it's hilarious that they thought of that, of this Chinese American man.
Yeah, I have to say, that's one of those moments where you're just like, that passed as a joke?
Apparently in 1992 it did.
Yeah, like, okay, I guess so. Maybe stick to the Pop-Tart material, it was much better.
Yeah, no, the Pop-Tart material, much funnier. And then we get more fights. We just rush on to more fights, which is fun. I like that.
Yes, we do. It's also kind of surprising that, so once these FBI agents kill the one guy who's not corrupt, there's three of them, they kill one guy who doesn't know what's going on. I'm surprised they don't just charge Jake like right at that moment, because they both have guns and he's just in the kitchen unarmed. But we need, you know, he's the hero of the story. We can't let it end that easily.
That is true. And, it is quite fun when he realizes those guys are corrupt, and he just the way he says, oh shit. Just as if he knows that, oh, now I'm going to have to like kick some ass again, and I'm going to have to, you know, like, it's going to be a big deal. I just wanted to eat something, and I wanted to, you know, like, these Pop-Tarts were the only thing that I could find, and I just wanted to eat these Pop-Tarts, and now I'm going to have to beat these guys up.
He really is a great, like, sarcastic but unfazed by that kind of thing character. Where it's like, well, that's just what's happening now.
I'm going to be attempted to be murdered by these FBI guys, you know, when all I wanted was Pop-Tarts. But, I suppose got to get on with it. And while the, you know, phoning for Chinese quote-unquote gag, it was totally not funny. What is funny is there is some good kind of physical gags in this, of like when he is beating up one of the FBI agents and then he just kicks the door in the face of the other FBI agent.
Yes.
And then he goes back to beating up the first FBI agent and then kicks the door in the face of the other FBI agent again. It's like, and then he just, and you hear the guy just screaming like, ah, oh, you broke my nose.
Yes. Even right before that too, like, has the one FBI agent storming the kitchen, he just throws like a drawer of silverware in his.
Yes, there is a lot of good, like, in terms of, you know, props to Brandon Lee and Jeff Hamada for the fight choreography in this movie, because like a lot of it's really good, and a lot of it is, I mean, Brandon Lee was a Jackie Chan fan. I think you can see that because there's a lot of environment work. And there's also a great moment as well, after he kicked the door into the guy's face a couple of times, where the first guy that he's beating up, is chasing after him, and he just slams the kind of freezer door in his face.
Yes.
And yeah, there's a lot of great environment work throughout the movie of like just using different props as weapons.
Yeah, and I think aside from Jackie Chan, you didn't see that a lot back then, obviously. So it stands out that much more. You're just like, oh, this is really good. This is better than I would have expected, maybe.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, like, audiences probably wouldn't be aware of that unless they were kind of Hong Kong action fans, because we're still like 3 years away from Rumble in the Bronx, which was like Jackie Chan's like big breakthrough in terms of like Western audience, in terms of like, yeah, mainstream anyway. Like, he, you know, people watched his, you know, people were a martial art movie fans were aware of things like Police Story and stuff like that, Drunken Master, you know, things that came out in the '80s. But, that was his kind of big mainstream breakthrough in terms of like American mainstream audience, or, you know, kind of Western mainstream audience. So I feel like a lot of people wouldn't necessarily be aware of those Jackie Chan references at the time.
From there we get, well, I know we get Jake like kind of swinging into the upper part of like a closet.
Yes. And then, after we get a really weird shot where the FBI agent is shooting into the closet, and it's like Brandon Lee in the shot is like kind of frozen in amber. It's in this kind of weird stasis. It's a very strange shot.
It's definitely a still frame that they like animated with light as the FBI agent is shooting through the door. But it's also like, I love it because it's just cheesy, but it kind of works. And you're just like, yeah, that's the height of filmmaking technology at this time, I guess. it'll be fine.
Yeah. Or,
I mean, I wonder what happened. Because I'm sure they could have afforded to just shoot through the door, or not shoot through the door, but, you know, fake it. But
yeah. But no, instead, they've got this weird still frame. It is a very strange shot. Like, it really stands out. But then just after that, like, he manages to get her there and he kills the guy, which is actually something that it's not like a kind of cool action movie hero kill. Like, he actually shows some, you know, like, he genuinely isn't prepared for this. Of like, he might have kind of badass skills, but like, he is like an art student. He's not like a secret CIA agent. He's not a, you know, one of the Navy SEAL characters that, you know, like, or Steven Seagal or anything like that. He's like this kind of unprepared hero in a way. And it's actually shown here in a way that's not really in the rest of the movie, but like, you know, it's a nice character beat.
Yeah. I think it adds a lot. It adds just more like, along with the kind of environment style fighting we were just talking about, of just being like a little bit different than your typical action movie.
Yeah. And, but then after that, he is, he's not a lucky character, is old Jake Lowe. Cause then after that, he is nearly arrested again for the second time in the movie. And we're about half an hour in.
Well, and yes, and now he meets his actual love interest, Detective Withers. And holds her hostage
for like 2 seconds.
Yes. And then
I feel like, it was just kind of weird that he, like, because there's like there's a car right there. I mean, you think he could have, I don't know, like, it felt like that scene might be like, oh, he takes her and then convinces her that he is innocent, or like he might have gone in something like that kind of direction, but It does not. He just lets her go like almost immediately, and it's like kind of, it wasn't me, and then he runs away.
Yeah, I was gonna say, he ends up running away anyway, so it just seemed like he could have just done that in the first place.
But yeah, for sure. It seems very odd that like the way he escaped there, and like you said, it looks like he could have just did what he actually did just like earlier, just ran away. But we do get like, again, we get like him kind of hurdling over things, and he is topless, and we get more loving loving ab shots like that, because that's what the movie's really about. It's about the abs of Brandon Lee.
Yeah, there is a good bit of this movie that also feels like it's selling his black tank top that he wears throughout a lot of it.
That is true. For the majority of the movie, he's either in that or he's topless, apart from when he's doing his cool undercover getup, which is what we'll talk about that later.
Which is a great outfit.
Oh, it's so good. It's also, like so many things in this film, it's so early 90s. It's amazing.
Yes.
Oh, this is the point where we find out that Frank, or Agent Stewart, is, he's corrupt. He is the person who sent those FBI agents to kill our hero, Jake Lowe.
Yes. And he, does anything else happen in the scene? He calls, Gotsy.
Yeah, he calls Gotsy. Yeah.
At Serrano's restaurant kind of hangout place. Well, he sets up, he says he's going to get him, basically. Doesn't he call Jake right after that? Or Jake calls him to meet that night?
Yes. Yes, they plan to meet that evening. And, yeah, I think I want to see.
Jake calls him right before, and then he calls Gotsy.
Yes, to say that he's going to, there's going to be a meetup with Jake, and he'll capture him, at the meetup. And that's when it's kind of revealed that he is a bad egg. And, I think this is where of the few restaurant scenes that we get, I think this is, where Serrano says to Gotsy that I'll have to get onto Lloyd's of London to ensure your stomach, while suggesting that he just eats a ludicrous amount of pasta. Because we see him digging into it, like, Serrano's eating a steak, and we see Gotsy just digging into a ludicrous amount of spaghetti.
And this is also where we get Serrano's philosophy, essentially, of like, he's telling some weird anecdote about a mayor that no one liked who then died, and he's like, you just gotta think positive. I'm like, okay.
You know, that is what will get you over, like, the fact that apparently you're broke and all your guys are in jail. Even though it looks like, for a guy who's broke, he's living at large, you know?
Yeah, he's doing pretty well.
he's eating fine steaks. He's, you know, it looks like he's got a real nice watch on, you know, like, it's not like he's, you know, selling his shit or anything like that. It doesn't seem like he's, you know, going down the pawn shop to, like, try and, you know, he doesn't even look like he's mildly bad off, you know? He looks like he's very much high on the hog.
Yes, but not with Jake Lowe running around.
No, not with Jake Lowe running around.
Literally running around.
Yeah, no, he does a lot of running around in the very much literal sense. But so then we get the meetup with Raymond, and that is interrupted by Lieutenant Mace Ryan, who, as mentioned, played by Powers Booth, who tells Jake to get in his car. Jake is unsure who has betrayed him, who's telling the truth, what's going on. And then before any real sort of tension can build up in this scene, action just happens. They just, people come out the woodwork, mafia guys are shooting guns, everybody's shooting guns, and we're hitting back off into the action again. You know, like this movie really doesn't fuck about. It's like, you know, you get like maybe 2 seconds of plot, and it's like the movie kind of knows exactly what it is, and it's just like, we know you've not come here for a story. You've come here for abs. You've come here for kung fu. You've come here for car explosions and gunfights, and that's what we're going to give you.
You are right. I think that's what's so great about it too, is it just, it gives you what you need, and then, you know, time for mobsters with Uzis to start walking across these fire escape.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where, like, we now, so in the background research, Brandon Lee, apparently, as we discussed off air, wanted John Woo to direct this film. And this, it's in this scene where we get a kind of John Woo type moment. Cause like, Jake is like, he picks up a couple of guns and he's like firing, guns in both hands. And then when he like runs out of bullets, he kind of drops the guns in slow motion, which again, obviously like John Woo is in 1992, not a big enough name in Hollywood for Brandon Lee to be able to convince them of that. So again, I feel like a lot of these references to John Woo movies, like the Jackie Chan thing, might have gone over the head of a 1992 audience in a way that it wouldn't, again, if it had come out just a few years later. Like if this movie had come out in the mid-90s, like 95, you know, like there'd already been the Hard Target. Like Broken Arrow would be the next again year, and Jackie Chan would have made his breakthrough with Rumble in the Bronx and that, you know, like feel like it might have resonated more if it came out a few years later, because it wasn't like a big hit or anything. But I just feel like, I don't know, what do you think?
No, yeah, I think you're right. I think people seeing it then wouldn't have noticed anything, you know, just been like, oh, that's kind of neat, and wouldn't have thought anything of it. Whereas, you know, we see now all the kind of influences or homages and stuff. Yeah, I'm surprised it wasn't that big of a hit.
No, it wasn't a massive hit. It was a relatively, like, you know, by Hollywood standards, relatively low budget action flick, had a budget of about estimated 10 million, made about 14 and a half million at the box office, according to Wikipedia anyway. So yeah, not really kind of underseen, not a huge hit at the time. And yeah, I think it had a little bit of a resurgence on video in the 90s, after, you know, after the release of The Crow. I think, you know, after Brandon Lee's death and then the release of The Crow, like his movies had a bit of a kind of uptick, particularly he started in a few movies before this, but like essentially, Showdown in Little Tokyo, which was the year before this film, and The Crow all had like, video sales, were quite high, you know, like, I think, you know, but again, you know, this movie has like 8,400 votes on IMDb, which is the lowest amount of IMDb votes of any film we've covered. And like to qualify for the like top 100 or bottom 100 on IMDb, you need like 10,000 votes. So it's below that. So it seems like it's a relatively underseen movie, you know, like it's, honestly, I don't know if it's just because like I had that video, whatever film it was, that had the trailer for this film and it had, you know, had Brandon Lee in it. And then, yeah, like I just thought it was like a bigger 90s action movie than it is, but it seems like it's relatively obscure.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I think now I need to start another hashtag to go with Justice for O'Malley. And just start some sort of rapid fire hashtag.
Yes, like, I feel like this should definitely be a more seen film. Like now I've discovered like how underseen it seems to be. I feel like that I want to promote this movie. And, because yeah, I think, you know, it's a really fun martial arts action movie. And I think it shows all the kind of charisma and potential that Brandon Lee had. And yeah, I definitely think if you're an action fan, and particularly if you like that kind of early 90s style, definitely people check out Rapid Fire. More people need to check out Rapid Fire.
Yes. And I think people today would eat up, like you were just kind of saying, it's just people today, the Jackie Chan moments and the John Woo moments would like, everyone would get that today and like really appreciate those things, I think, more.
Yeah. I think again, like as I, like it's weird because it's weird to look back because as a kid, I was always a fan of martial art movies. So I've had like a knowledge of martial art movies for a long time. And so like growing up in the '90s, I because you assume that kind of a lot of people are into what you're into or whatever, that there would be a kind of knowledge back then of like martial art movies. Cause I'm like, you know, like obviously Jackie Chan was popular in the '80s and like, you know, Bruce Lee was big in the '70s. So, and it's weird looking back that like Hollywood did have like this big ignorance of martial art cinema, and the Matrix was like this kind of big breakthrough in terms of like the whole fight choreography really changes in like mainstream films completely to this more kind of Hong Kong style. And then obviously in more recent years, obviously a lot of films incorporate like MMA style fighting. That seems to be the big thing that happened in the kind of last decade or so. But it's just weird because I just felt like it should be more known, or that like, yeah, that was, there was a great, I felt like there was a greater awareness than there actually was.
And now it's our job to change that.
if this podcast accomplishes anything, it will increase the popularity of Rapid Fire.
We've got to get back to the action.
We do need to get back to the action. So the next question on my notes was, where did Powers get that shotgun from? He was just carrying it about in the car, I suppose, but like it just kind of comes out of nowhere. Like he has kind of regulation gun, and then he just pulls out the shotgun.
I love that he causes that car to flip and like explode. And then they just kind of take off, and it's like, you're a cop. Still kind of your job to like deal with the aftermath. Like, no, we got to get to the bowling alley.
Exactly. Cause they're a special undercover bowling alley unit. I don't know. Let's not question the tactics of Lieutenant Mace Ryan. He must have reached, you know, Lieutenant somehow, you know, like, he knows what's going on.
Yeah. And with a first name like Mace, I mean, you just let that guy do whatever he wants, I think.
It's true. Yeah. Also, like we had discussed, once we get back to the bowling alley, like Mace Ryan kind of explains Jake's position to him of like, how he has to, once again, Jake is kind of blackmailed into helping people out. And he is, it's basically explained to him that, you know, all the cops would be after him. And again, we get a good moment of him being like the kind of sarcastic hero, where Mace is like, you know, what do you think is going to happen to you with all these Chicago cops? And he just says, I guess I'll be off the department's Christmas list.
He's got really good one-liners.
Yeah, no, there's definitely some good kind of cheesy one-liners in this movie. Yeah.
And we also get the kind of payoff of his briefly holding Withers hostage, where she just punches him in the face, which is kind of great.
Yes. Yes. So like that is great. That is great fun. Like, she just punches him and seems to have real kind of heat with him. And until the very next scene in which she is in love with him, like that is not developed at all. It just, she goes from being like, why I got it, to being like, oh, he's such a hunk. You know, like.
I mean, and again, I appreciate their self-awareness that they're just like, everybody loves Brandon Lee. We don't have to explain this. She's, you know, she punched him and now she's in love with him.
She got it out of her system, and that's all she needed to do. And now she can realize what a handsome, handsome man Brandon Lee is. Yeah, but we move on with the action. Well, we don't actually. We get some actual character development for a second, because we get some bonding between Brandon Lee's character and Powers Booth's character, where we realize that Powers Booth's character will become a replacement father figure because he is similar to Jake Lowe's father, who we saw in the flashback had died in Tiananmen Square in the protests.
Yes, and I think they do a pretty good job with that, considering this 90s action of it all. It's just what ends up happening with Powers Booth towards the end. It's all like a good little tie-in.
Yes, I would say that throughout the movie, most of the cast are like, you know, like the script is kind of like a cheesy 90s action script and they've not got a whole lot to deal with. But most of the cast are pretty good. Of the central cast, I mean, Powers Booth is good. Mm. Brandon Lee is good. Kate Hodge plays her character serviceably. Raymond J. Barry plays the corrupt Agent Frank Stewart. He's pretty good. Nick Mancuso does his Nick Mancuso thing, and he's good at doing his Nick Mancuso thing. You know, like,
yes.
It's pretty solid throughout.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And, what's his, no, I'm going to mess up his name, Zima.
It, like, I saw on, like, on IMDb, it says it's pronounced Tema or Taima.
Tema.
So yes, he is also good in the movie. And we apologize for possibly mangling your name.
Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry. It's hard. It's hard to not pronounce a Z.
Yes, it is. It is. It is. It throws me off as well. So, like, yes, I hope that I have pronounced it correctly. I hope. Yeah. It is. So, anyway, what's going on now? After the bonding, we go on to Frank's house and tell us about what happened. What goes down at Frank's house?
Man, now? Jake kicks the shit out of Frank. Including like slamming into this like sort of glass case. And I love that his wife comes out to like intervene and he's just like, he's bleeding and stuff. And he's like, no, no, it's okay. We were just talking. And she just goes back in the other room. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is real good. But then basically, so there's been that kind of Powers knows that or Lieutenant Mace Ryan knows that Frank is corrupt because he's got a recording of it, and now he is blackmailed into phoning our old friend Nick Mancuso, or Antonio Serrano called in the movie, and we arrange for another meetup where Frank will drop off Jake Lowe at the restaurant where the gangsters are apparently just always there, just always having meals and stuff.
All they do is eat.
Again, I feel like that's more kind of early 90s casual racism of like, of course, Italians.
Yes, yeah. We also get, so like, this is where it gets not as confusing as maybe this movie could get, because Powers yeah. Booth wants to find out when or where Tao's next shipment is coming in. So part of this whole ruse is to like them to wear wires and get Serrano to tell them about this heroin shipment.
Yes. I don't know if this confused you as well. So when Frank phones the restaurant the second time and he demands to talk to Serrano, like Gazi again answers the phone and he says like, ah, you know, like he initially kind of shouts at him and Serrano is like, oh, who's that on the phone? And he says, oh, it's Stewart on the phone. Now, he doesn't say Agent Stewart. And, like, up till this point, I think the character has almost always been referred to as Frank. So I was confused.
Yeah.
Because obviously Stewart can be a first name and a surname. And I was just like, oh, Stewart? Who's Stewart? And then I was like, that must be Frank's surname, right?
Yeah. Well, and they've also kind of implied that that Frank only talks to Gazi. So then when they're talking about him more like casually, you know, it seems like he's dealt with Serrano before, even though he's said that he doesn't. And that's putting way too much. That's thinking about it way too much.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. Anyway, yeah, after that, we cut back to the bowling alley. More bowling alley action, and And now Kate, this is where Kate is now in love with Brandon Lee. She's like, when they're working at the complete model recreation of the yes. restaurant to, with toy cars and everything. They've got everything in this bowling alley. Like, I wonder if they have that for every stakeout. They have like, who is the miniature model maker in the bowling alley for it? Like, it's like, and now, right, so the stakeout this time, it's going to be a restaurant and we need to have the opposing, car park, built so you can see that. And then, just use your little toy sniper guys and like the little toy cars and that'll be perfect.
And we don't have enough funds to get a legitimate place to operate out of besides this derelict bowling alley, but we can pay you to make these models. Yeah, considering like how sideways everything goes too, it seems like so funny how detailed their plan is.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't take the scene seriously where they were discussing the stakeout over like in this table that had this miniature model of like what the drop off would look like.
Well, and considering that we've seen Serrano sitting in the same spot in his restaurant, it doesn't seem like brilliant intelligence work that they're like, we know where he sits every time. It's like, that's all he's been doing the whole movie.
Sitting there, he just goes to this one restaurant and he's always sitting at the same table. Like, they're like, you don't need to be an intelligence officer.
Exactly. But I do love that she transitions from like Jake says something about like, oh, you know, like everything about Serrano. And she's like, oh, I know everything about you too. And she like knows his whole background.
Oh yeah. She knows how his dad died. She says she knows something about his MasterCard debt or something. It was like, all right. It's kind of creepy lady, but yeah, fair. So yeah, she knows everything about everybody because she's an intelligence officer and that's all we need to know. So yeah, Frank or Agent Frank Stewart, as we now have to call him, they're going to the restaurant. He drops Jake off and then we get more casual racism from Mancuso. That's his favorite thing to do, to make weird jokes about Asian people and put on cartoon accents. And so yes, but we'll skip over that kind of weird awkwardness. And basically, despite the fact that Agent Frank Stewart is apparently a very experienced FBI agent, he does not do this undercover mission with any sort of assuredness at all. In fact, he pretty much gives the game away immediately with how squeamish he looks and how much he clearly in his eyes wants to get out of there.
Yeah, which is just weird considering he's already a corrupt FBI agent, like making deals with mobsters. He should be fine with this.
He really should.
But he's not. But so, I mean, there's a lot that well, I know like Serrano is threatening to he beats up Jake a little bit and is threatening to beat him really badly. But then Frank says there's like, they know about his heroin shipment. So they've got to like alter their plans essentially kind of.
Yes.
And Serrano kind of bullies him into saying like, you'll do that for free. And then we get to the like key moment of the, Frank's safe word is, nice doing business with you or whatever. And he just keeps repeating it.
Like an absolute mental case.
Yes.
Which obviously tips Serrano off just a little bit. And Serrano proceeds to, like, he's not like the subtlest of gangsters. You know, for like, there is a scene earlier on in the movie, in the interrogation scene, with the one with Basil Wallace, where it said that Serrano has not killed anybody with his own hand in 15 years because he knows basically how to distance himself from the crimes, and therefore that's why he's not been arrested. And I was like, but he shows no evidence of this in the actual movie, where he seems completely trigger happy and quite happy to kill people in broad daylight.
Yeah. Which is the whole plot of the movie, is he's been witnessed killing someone and he has to kill that witness. Yeah. But again, logic, I mean, it's not important. It sounded good in the first scene, but we don't have to stick to it.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, we basically get to the point of what this movie is again, because we get another big fight sequence. Tell us about some of the things that happen in the big fight sequence.
All I really remember is, like, so there's snipers who could have shot Serrano, but then they lose their shot. But I remember just kind of thinking, like, how is Brandon Lee not dead? Because he's just in a room full of mafia guys with guns, but they're all just kind of distracted by the cops outside. So he's doing a lot of running around and kicking the shit out of people, but I'm like, oh man, there's like four guys in the back of the frame that all could just turn around and kill you right now.
But yeah, they're not going absolutely. To. I think the things that stood out for me were that, so there's a one thing where he is beating up a guy, and then there's a sequence where he has to, like, he backflips over a guy and then catches a shotgun, shoots a guy with a shotgun.
Oh, yes.
Which is real cool. And then he has, like, a kind of big henchman fight with Gazi, where, like, Gazi is initially, like, taking all his punches and just coming towards him, you know, not being stopped by any of the things he's doing. And then he eventually, like, kicks out a kind of foundation of, like, you know, this kind of balcony bit in the restaurant, which collapses the whole balcony onto Gazi's head, and that's him out of the movie, R.I.P. And I also did want to say that I realized that I did say at the start of the episode that I would be counting up the Seagal connections. I've not really done that. So I do want to do it at this point, because there is a Seagal connection in this scene. So, Seagal connection number one, as we've discussed, directed by Dwight H. Little, who also directed Mark for Death. Seagal connection number two, as we've also mentioned, actor Nick Mancuso, who also played CIA agent Tom Breaker in Under Siege. Number three, which is also in the opening credits, is that the director of photography on this film is Rick Waite, who is the director of photography on Mark for Death, Out for Justice, and On Deadly Ground. Number four, is the appearance of actor Basil Wallace, who was also in Marked for Death. And number five also happens in this scene. So number five is a cameo from Judo Jean LaBelle, who is the red-haired guy who is firing the gun, the twin-barreled turret machine gun that is being fired out the restaurant window onto the various cop cars and stuff like that, is being shot by Judo Jean LaBelle. And according to legend, Judo Jean LaBelle allegedly choked Seagal out on the set of Out for Justice. So that is connection number five. So that is the count so far. There could be more connections to come.
I think there will be.
Don't spoil it, Kyle. But yes, there's going to be more connections. Anyway. Well, basically, Jake Lowe does somehow manage to survive all this chaos. And we get more fun. Like, he does have some fun one-liners, because, like, I like this one-liner as well, where he is telling Mace off for, like, everything going sideways. But he, before that, he says, oh, I think they're looking for a police commissioner in Beirut. Which I thought was quite a fun line.
Yeah, that was a great line. It was also just like, this is also the point of the movie where you're like, man, Jake Lowe is better than this entire police department. There's something wrong in Chicago. he just handled that whole situation way better than them.
Yes, that is true. This art major with no military or policing or secret service or any sort of experience apart from just like trained real well in martial arts by his dad, and apparently marksmanship as well, because he's shooting off guns like a pro. So like he was just trained to be a killing machine by his dad, just on the weekends maybe.
Just runs in the family, I guess.
Yeah, just that low blood is what you mean. Like, oh, that was another thing from the research. Right, well, this is one of those things in the IMDb trivia, is that there is a kind of connection to Bruce Lee in terms of Bruce Lee's character in Game of Death was Billy Lowe, and his character Jake Lowe. So that might have been a deliberate reference. There is also, like, we didn't mention it, but in the, when they go around to Frank's house, there is like a Bruce Lee, the one main Bruce Lee reference in the film is where Powers Booth character says, can you go take your Fist of Furies elsewhere? That was like a kind of deliberate reference, and Brian Lee didn't want to make it too deliberate a reference to his, but he wanted just that he thought that one would be quite cool, but without making it super heavy handed. And he was just like, you know, the people who know will know, and you know, everybody else, it will just sound like a kind of fun line anyway.
Yeah, and I think it works pretty well. It helps. Yeah. It helps to have Powers Booth be the one delivering your reference.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
But we've got more backstory.
We do have more backstory. It's weird because, like, this film is structured kind of weird in that, so we get this big shootout, and obviously Serrano is arrested after being beaten up by Jake, and it feels like that when Jake is walking away from the crime scene with Carla, it kind of feels like the end scene of a movie, like where he's kind of does that kind of quippy, like, I think I've had enough of law enforcement kind of line. It's like, you could imagine like being like end credits now, you know, like a, you know, fun rock song kicking in and that's the end credits. But we're like, it's not. We're like 2/3 of the way through the movie. And it's kind of structured weird in that we've got this investigation and then like there's this whole second investigation. Like it's a kind of continuing television show.
Yeah, I felt that way too. But of course, because it's Brandon Lee and this movie's been so fun up to this point, we're fine with another 20 to 30 minutes.
That is true. That is true. Particularly from what we get, next. So Kate is an intelligence officer. And because she's an intelligence officer, she manages to get Jake's father's military file, which Jake has been trying to get for years, apparently, but has not got. Again, this is kind of, in plot terms, in kind of story terms, this is another weird moment because it sets itself up as being more important than it actually is. Because the way Jake talks about the case of his dad's death, the way he looks at the file and he just goes like, oh, like I, you know, I think they've, you know, there's definitely stuff missing here or whatever. It makes it sound like there's like some sort of conspiracy. And it makes it sound like it's maybe kind of closer tied into the plot of like, oh, maybe we'll find out that Tao somehow was involved in the death of his father or something. Like, it seems important, and yet it's never mentioned again, and it's absolutely not important.
Yes. Yeah, it's a weird, like, I think it's just a scene to get those two together. Because we also, like, have that kind of bit of information that we cut away, and we kind of, once we cut back, he's just kind of grieving over his father's death so that, of course, she can kind of kiss him, basically. So they can hook up.
Ah, dear. And then, I mean, entertainment happens afterward. What happened? Like, tell us what happens next, Kyle.
I mean, then we get like just the super 90s sex scene ever. But we also get like, isn't it intercut with Tao, like, shipping the heroin or something? I know there's something else going on.
So, in this scene that is scored by American hard rock band Hardline. just wanted to throw that out there. So we got this kind of cheesy rock score going on. And there is this, like you say, super early 90s lovemaking scene going on, and a lot of ab love again, you know, like a close up of her kissing his abs and stuff like that. It's, I mean, this movie was sponsored by Brandon Lee's abs. So as well as that, we've got Tao doing his heroin deal. We've got, Mace Ryan and his gang, the cops doing like investigating the laundry that they think is where the heroin's being laundered through, and we also get the assassination of Serrano from everybody's favorite henchman Al Leong. So we're getting a lot of things it's the bizarrest that they've decided to intercut all these things with this love scene, but you know, it's great that they did.
Yeah, it makes it a little bit more fun or funny. But, well, this is where I was going to say, I mean, technically we could connect Al Leong to Seagal, right? I mean, this is kind of cheating because he's in like every movie, every martial arts movie ever.
Yes. Well, I couldn't, yeah, that was the thing. I was like, oh, Al Leong's got to have been in a Seagal movie, but I couldn't actually see for, like, I was scanning his IMDb and I couldn't actually see, like, one in his filmography, which is weird because as people will probably know if they're listening to this podcast, Al Leong is a henchman in Lethal Weapon, in Die Hard, in Big Trouble in Little China. He's in everything. He's Genghis Khan in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. He's in everything. And yet I could not find, or not one that like I know, like maybe there's one from the 2000s that I'm like missing or something, but like when I was looking through the 90s, couldn't see a Seagal film because I was surprised because I was like, oh, that's bound to be another connection. But,
that's like a pockmark on Seagal's record.
Yeah, that Al Leong was not a henchman in one of his movies. No, I just don't see.
I'm looking now because I have to know, and it doesn't look like he was.
No, it doesn't look like he was at all. They did not cross paths. So there we go. Not a Seagal connection. Not one of the Seagal connections that I picked up. So there you go. But that's quite a fun scene as well, because like Serrano's like kind of pleading for his life, and then Al Leong kills him with some ninja stars.
Because again, this is the 90s.
What would be the most stereotypical weapon to give this guy?
We have to say we're surprised that when he's hit with the ninja stars, like spaghetti didn't come out of his belly or something.
that is true. He just bleeds a bolognese sauce. to be fair, we've mentioned a lot about how badly stereotyped Asian people are in this movie. All ethnic minorities are stereotyped in this movie. Well, the two ethnic minorities that we get, you know, Italians and Chinese. That is, but again, you know, because it's the early 90s, and that's what happened. After that, we get a scene, we get a fun scene where Mace is after the kind of post-coital scene where Mace kind of comes in to Carla's apartment and professes his love for Jake Lowe. But he can't say it out loud because Jake obviously knows because, you know, just, you know, you know, when a man loves a man, they just instinctively know. And that's how men work.
Pretty much. It is a great moment with Brandon Lee, like, listening from the other room.
Yeah,
just basking in it.
Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting thing as well. So at this point in the film, and again, I think it's just like, because of course, because it's Asian gangsters. So when he comes into the apartment, he says the raid was a bust and that Tao possibly had a mole. Now, in that scene, we see Faris giving a strange look to the camera, which suggests that he's up to something suspicious, and then Mace delivers that line, and then Faris is not seen in the movie again.
Mm. I wonder if that's like a subplot that got cut or something.
Yeah, like it feels weird. Yeah, maybe. Maybe there is a longer version of this movie where that is explained, but it just feels like a kind of weird moment. Cause he looks in the camera in such a way of that it's like, oh, this is like an intended moment of like, you're supposed to be thinking like, is he up to something suspicious? He just gives this weird sideway glance and you're like, oh, has he been tipping Tao off this whole time and it's not been a plot point up until this exact second?
Well, but then again, like if that were the case, it almost just underlines all of this kind of 90s racism where it's like the one Chinese guy on the force.
Yes.
Actually working with a crime boss. Like, come on.
That's what I was thinking as well. I was like, cause when they were talking about it, I was like, oh, so was Faris the mole? And then if he was the mole, then that's just like, this kind of typical kind of Hollywood thinking of the time of being like, well, of course the Asian guy is going to be the one who betrays everybody for the Asian gang.
Oh, Hollywood.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. And everybody thinks Hollywood's super liberal. That's weird. But anyway.
Not in the 90s.
Not
that's
in
for
the
sure.
90s. Anyway, I want to discuss this scene. It doesn't mean anything, but I just want to discuss it. Because the very next note I made was, yeah, fuck that bowling pin.
Yes, that's what that scene is.
So, do you want to explain that comment to the audience, Kyle?
Yes. So basically, we're at the bowling alley again, and it seems like this investigation is unsuccessful and is over. So Powers Booth shoots a bowling pin, has his coworkers are like packing everything into boxes. And then, of course, Jake and Carla come walking through the door because they're not going to let this investigation stop there, which is like, yeah. You could have totally done that in the apartment, but I love that this movie knows that, like, this movie is about people walking through doors and yeah. Powers Booth being like, son of a bitch.
The entertaining thing about this is, like, we've not mentioned it up until this point, but as a kind of recurring motif and metaphor for how the slog of this case, Powers Booth there's been a couple of scenes of him kind of trying to get there's only one bowling pin set up. There's just the one. And he's been trying to bowl this one bowling pin and he just repeatedly failed. And it's kind of this metaphor of him kind of keep trying to get Tao, the metaphor reflecting the investigation. And then he just shoots it and it like blows up and it's an amazing moment. And like you say, it's again, classic 90s action when Jake and Carla come through the door and they've got that kind of soft, kind of slightly out of focus shot of like can't quite make out their faces. And then it comes into focus and guess what? It's Jake and Carla and fuck yeah, the game is back on.
It's really a great moment.
It's nice. It is, it's a proper kind of like, punch in the air type moment. And the fact that like 2 seconds before we saw a bowling pin blow up because the guy got so frustrated at bowling, he shot a bowling pin. It's amazing.
Oh,
dear.
Well, and then we're on to the best undercover outfit I've ever seen on Committed to Celluloid.
Yeah. Tell us about the undercover outfit. Yeah.
I guess basically Jake is going to infiltrate the laundry. And so he's got like, it's not really a kung fu or an Asian shirt of any kind. He's just kind of got this.
It's surprising because this is the first time he is wearing a proper shirt that covers his arms and everything. You know?
Yes. So he's just got that shirt and like a black bandana and glasses Because, of course, you know, I don't know, guys with glasses are trustworthy or inconspicuous.
Inconspicuous. If you want to be inconspicuous in a movie, or, like, I mean, this was a thing in the 80s and 90s, I think. Yes. Like, if you wanted to be inconspicuous in a movie, or nerdy in a movie, or the ugly girl in a movie, glasses.
Well, and to be fair, I wear glasses, and wearing glasses right now, I constantly look around and just go, like, you guys can't see me, right?
You just always feel like an undercover agent. I mean, like, I just have glasses for reading, so I only sometimes feel like an undercover.
You're lucky. You can turn it on and turn it off.
Yeah, I'm like Clark Kent. Yeah, I do feel like maybe that is where it stems from, of just being like, well, it worked for Superman. Sure.
Yes. I feel like, and I have no evidence to back it up either, I feel like it might have happened in a Bruce Lee movie. Like, it feels like a Bruce Lee movie gag, too. Like, I could see him doing the same kind of a thing.
Oh, yes.
And I don't know if it has actually happened, but.
That is true. I think we're, like, yeah, there is definitely, I think it might be, like, Fist of Fury where I think it's Fist of Fury where he pretends to be, like an electrical guy or something. Like when he go, it's a while since I watched that movie. Like he pretends to be some sort of like maintenance guy, going into the dojo and then like, you know, it's like, ah, surprise. But he's doing, so it definitely happens in a Bruce Lee film. I want to say it's Fist of Fury. He does that where he pretends to be like the maintenance guy.
Sounds right.
Anyway, yeah. So that's true, yeah. So I'm not sure it's like a deliberate callback, but it definitely happens in a Bruce Lee film. Yeah. So, but I mean, like all these things, I mean, it goes sideways pretty quickly.
Yeah, pretty. I mean, he kind of pretends to work for like 2 seconds, and then he wanders through a bunch of steam and finds hoses full of cocaine or heroin or whatever.
It looks like cocaine, but like they've been saying throughout the movie that they've been dealing heroin, so so we are obviously supposed to assume that it is heroin.
I think heroin and cocaine can both be white powder. I don't know. Again, you know, this is rapid fire. It's not important.
It's not important. What is important is whoever the mole was, whether it was Faris or not, has obviously tipped Tao off, so he knows all about this, this undercover operation that's going to go down. He, for some reason, despite the fact he knows all about that, he doesn't really seem to know about Jake. He just seems to know about Carla and Mace.
Yeah, and you would think he would have heard about Jake, considering all that's happened, but whatever.
Yeah, if it was like a mole from the bowling alley unit. But yeah, it seems weird because, yeah, like the way he says his lines when he captures them, it does very much seem like, and the way his interaction with Jake goes seems very much like he doesn't know that he was part of it, and it was just like Mace and Carla. It's kind of weird,
but whatever.
I mean, yeah, just, whatever.
He's just an art student. And everyone else knows about him and his dad, but this guy doesn't.
I also like, you know, some of the lines in this movie are very fun because, like, Tara is talking about how Mace Ryan has got kind of sloppy, and he used to be a worthy opponent, but now he's got sloppy, and Mace's reply is like, you make it sound like we've been playing chess in the park for 10 years. And then he follows it up by saying, like, oh, this is the way it is. I'm a cop. You're a piece of shit.
I love Powers Booth in this movie.
Oh, Powers Booth is great in this movie. I mean, and like his rapport with Ron Lee is really good as well. Like they really work together. So it's actually quite sad. In the behind the scenes featurette that you can watch on YouTube, like Powers Booth is interviewed. It's like the featurette's only about 8 minutes long or 7.5 minutes long. And he's actually briefly interviewed, and like he's talking about Brandon Lee, and he's like, oh yeah, you know, like obviously he's really good at the martial arts and the fighting and stuff, but you know, like on top of that, you know, he's got a hard work ethic, you know, and he really knows his stuff, and he's really developing, and he clearly has a bright future ahead of him. And it's just quite, and you just hear that and you just go like, oh man.
Sad.
It just sucks. You know, it's like, yeah, I could have definitely, you know, watched him in more, way more movies. And I'm sad that we don't get a chance to watch him in way more movies, but at least we do have, we have this and we have The Crow, and you know, like that's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's a bummer.
Yeah.
And no offense to Seagal, as we've dedicated a whole season, but yeah, even watching this, you're like, man, Brandon Lee would have blown a lot of guys out of the water.
Yeah, I mean, like, it would have been interesting to see where he developed from The Crow and stuff like that. And apparently there was talks of an actual sequel to this movie at the time, where just as the Crow was going into filming. And apparently one of the scripts that was talked about being optioned was the script Simon Says, which would go on to be Die Hard with a Vengeance.
That would have been interesting.
Yeah, it would have been. So
it would have been. I mean, it would have been great to see Lee and Powers Booth in anything again.
Oh yeah, I would definitely take more Lee and Powers Booth. Like, yeah, I could have a rapid fire franchise. I would have been happy with a rapid fire franchise of the continuing adventures of Jake Lowe and Mace Ryan. And, you know, Carl is a fun character as well. Like, you know, and, he just becomes a member of the team of the bowling alley unit. Like, they just, you know, despite the successful bust of this gangster that they've been falling for 10 years, they still haven't upgraded the offices, you know. I could definitely take a couple more movies of that for sure.
Yeah, I'd be down for that. But so we got to finish this movie.
We do have to finish this movie. So we basically, Mace and Carla are tied up, and Tau is taunting them, and we discussed some of the back and forth there. And then Jake, in his typical subtle style, bursts through the window riding a laundry bag.
Yes. Who does, and then he hits one of Tao's henchmen, right?
Not yeah, Tao himself. Yeah. He just hits one of Tao's henchmen. And it's like, I do not know the actor's name. I couldn't find the actor's name. I'm not, like, but the guy with a big bushy mustache is in Samurai Cop. But anyway. Yes, guys, I just made a Samurai Cop reference. I definitely want to do a Samurai Cop episode one day. That will be hilarious. Anyway, moving on. I feel like we've had some great fight scenes in the movie. I think, like, the fight scene in the restaurant was really good, and the fight scene at the flat, the kind of motel, I thought that was really good as well. But I think this might be like the best fight scene, where he's fighting the two guys and one of them's got nunchucks, and he knocks the nunchucks out of his hand with some laundry, and then he beats another guy up like using a clothes rail. And then we have like the big showdown with Al Leong, and his fight with Al Leong, I think, is really, really good stuff. And apparently, according to trivia, this was Al Leong's favorite death in a movie.
That makes sense. It is like, yeah, it is one of the best. I think it's probably the best fight in the movie, just because it actually feels pretty even.
It does feel even. And I feel like it throws in a bunch of different stuff and a bunch of different styles, and like the different fighting styles that Brandon Lee knew, because like there, you know, there's a moment where he kind of puts him into a kind of Tai Plum and like hits him with some knees, and then there's a moment where both of them are throwing punches at each other, but like deflecting it. And it's obviously like the kind of movements that you would see like, a Wing Chun fighter, like using the Wing Chun wooden dummy and stuff like that. And, yeah, and there's some Jeet Kune Do moves, and then there's a nice movement where there's like a kind of chain fence where he does this kind of monkey yes. maneuver on, and yeah, no, and like you say, it's real even between Jake and Ali-Ong's character, who's called Min. So yeah, I think it's definitely the best fight in the movie, and I think it's the fight that has probably been choreographed the most, and obviously both Ali-Ong and Brandon Lee are excellent martial artists or on screen martial artists, so like it just looks real cool.
This is the same one too where there's like one sort of dolly shot where there's like one long take where they're just, I think it's kind of the Wing Chun moves you were talking about, where they're just kind of parrying and blocking each other.
Yeah, that's the yeah. kind of Wing Chun thing that I was talking about, the kind of parrying kind of moves with their hands, their arms. Yes, that's where that shot comes, yeah, for sure. He also does it like another, like I said earlier about the move where, you know, you catch the guy's foot in your side and then he hits you with his other foot in the face. Another move that I always entertain to see is the kind of nip up move where he just kind of springboards up, that he does like a few times as well.
Mm.
I don't know. I just think it looks real cool. Also, like there is in the fight where he beats the two guys up, there is a cool move as well where he takes two guys out at once with a wheel kick, which was good.
I love the fence climbing. Just looks cool.
Yes, the fence climbing does look very cool, yes. But he does manage to kill Min, played by Ali-Ong. And then there's not much left. There's just Tao. Tao's the only character, bad guy character left to take out. And oh, how he is taken out. Can you tell us about the death of Tao, Kyle?
Yes. It's pretty epic to follow up the Leong fight. He jumps off the roof onto the roof of a train station, which again is another place I actually know. It's actually a train stop that's still there, but
oh, cool.
Which is cool. But he jumps down to the platform and runs across the tracks to the other side, and Jake follows him, and they get into a fight with these kind of like, I guess they must be switch poles for the tracks or something. I don't know what they are. They're just kind of there.
Yeah, most...
But they get into a fight with it, and he pins Jake in front of a oncoming train. And Jake has dropped his pole, but he manages to break free. And what is he? Does he kick his pole up towards Tao? Is that like what distracts him?
Yes.
Yeah, because Tao ends up basically holding both metal poles that are touching both the third rails at the same time, which is pretty great. And then he falls down, and then another train comes and just slams right into him.
Yes. So, like, this death made me literally laugh out loud. It was just because the over-the-top way he gets electrocuted is very, very funny. But then, like, what makes it, like, a kind of Naked Gun bad guy death is, like, just him getting smooshed by the train afterwards. And not only is he smooshed by the train, like, as the train comes onto him, like, they slightly speed up the footage, which makes it even more comical.
You know, it almost felt to me like a horror, like a Halloween death, too, where it's like, now this guy's Michael Myers. Like, you have to beat him up, you have to electrocute him, you have to run him over.
And yes, right. Yeah. Well, that kind of slasher villain death. Yeah, for sure. You have to kill him in like five different ways to finally defeat him until the next film. Yeah. But we still not quite finished. Even though the big bad is dead, there's still something. So Mace, we should have mentioned that Mace was earlier on, after like being freed by Jake, was shot by one of the henchmen. So he is, and the building is now on fire, and so we've got to get Mace out of the burning building. Does Jake get Mace out of the burning building, Kyle, is the burning question.
Not only does he get Mace out of the burning building, he heals his inner wound of not having saved his father and saves Mace, who is now his father figure. And the cycle is complete.
It is indeed. So not only is it a great heroic moment, but he's also healed some very important psychological wounds, which means he is now part of the team. And then we greet a great typical early 90s action movie ending where somebody is being wheeled into the ambulance.
Yes.
And we get one more kind of, we get some more quipping, and then there's an one of the paramedics says, you know, basically in reference to, are you coming into the ambulance or are you just staying out there? When Jake Lowe says the line, we're in, we know he means more than just coming into the ambulance. he is in with the team, and the bowling alley, the Fireside Bowling Alley undercover unit now has Jake Lowe on the force. And it's a real shame we don't get Rapid Fire 2, because like all the adventures we could have had.
It's so good. Yeah, that ending is like peak 90s action.
What makes it even more peak 90s action is directly after he says the line, we're in, the song I'll Be There by American hard rock band Hardline kicks in, and it's oh so good.
There's just nothing like it, man. I wish we could make a 90s action movie that was unironic.
Yeah. Just
throw some cheesy rock in there.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. Now, at this point, listener, you might be thinking, but Scott, you said there would be more Seagal connections, and we have reached the end of the movie. There is no more movie. Well, you would be correct, listener, but there is two more Seagal connections, because in the credits, because I was reading the credits just to see if I could find more Seagal connections. So in the credits, the second unit camera operator was Don E. Fauntleroy. Now, Don E. Fauntleroy would go on to direct 3 Steven Seagal pictures, Today You Die, Mercenary for Justice, and Urban Justice. There is one more Seagal connection, taking our tally up to 7. So this one comes from IMDb. So it doesn't come from the credits, because apparently it was uncredited. So apparently, uncredited for stunts was a Mr. Branscombe Richmond, who you will remember played Quintero in Hard to Kill. There we go. Our 7 Seagal connections.
It's like there is a god. Well, and I feel like I have to make the honorable mention connection of Chicago, only because Marked for Death was there, and what, Nico? And I feel like there's maybe one other one where Chicago was kind of part of it somewhere in there.
Yes.
For sure, Mark for Death and Nico.
Yes, Mark for Death and Nico both definitely set in Chicago. And yeah, no, I felt like there was one more.
Yeah, I feel like there was one more where it was
I do feel like there's one more that we've recently talked about that we're never forgetting.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like there was one where they went to Chicago just for part of it or something weird like that, where it was like they were bouncing different locations.
For sure. I honestly can't remember.
I mean, yeah, we've watched more Seagal than most people have in a lifetime.
Yeah, and I've watched a couple of his direct-to-video efforts this year as well, so there we go. Like,
yeah, and I mean, I think Craig is convalescing right now. I think the Seagal has like destroyed his.
Yeah,
his
yeah. He's just recovering right now. He's he couldn't take it anymore. Like really, that's what happened. Which is we know like which, but like he tapped out at the wrong moment. Like you know, if he wanted to tap out, you know, he could have tapped out for the Patriot or something. But no, he could have. Yeah, he picked the wrong one.
He's going to be another one of those people I'm going to try and get to watch rapid fire and rate it on IMDb.
Yeah, for sure. But then, yes, so we have reached the end. We have reached the end of the film. We have reached the end of the Seagal Connection. Sadly, we have also reached the end of this episode. So it just leaves me to thank Kyle once again. For being my loyal co-host on this journey. And thank you, listener, as well, for checking out this latest episode. Is there anything you want to say before we wrap this one up, Kyle?
I mean, I would like to tell you how much I like you, but, you know, I can't say that.
but I know deep down, and that's all that matters. But Until next season. So next season, we will be coming back to you in late May. The season opener will be Rocky V in May 26th. But until then, we will see you in 4 weeks' time.